Welcome to Tech Life Stories, sponsored by talent staffing firm Russell King Associates. My name is Khan Azmi and I'm your host. You will find me posting daily on LinkedIn, so connect with me there for more about the crazy world of technology. I have spent the past 25 years talking to tech leaders, so we will go behind the scenes each week, taking a deep dive into interviewing tech leaders to understand their journey from when they started to where they are today. I'll be finding out more about why they got into tech, discussing their work history, some of the projects they've been part of, some of the most influential people in their career, and much more. We produce a weekly show which is available every Monday at 6 a.m, just in time to start your week in the right way. And the podcast will be available on all platforms, including Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts. If you prefer to see us visually, you can also find us on YouTube channel, Tech Life Stories. So remember, it's not what people think of you when you first start, it's what people think of you when you finish. Right, welcome everyone to Tech Life Stories. I'm joined today by David Barrow. David is an author of two books. One is An Education in Service Management, and the other, Co-Creating Value in Organizations with ITIL4. He's also a 2024 HCI Top 25 Thought Leader. I've got a long list here, guys, so bear with me. He's also a Service Integration and Management Champion, a Women in Tech Ambassador. He's an ITIL4 Master and Ambassador, and he's also a committee member for BSI, BCS, and ISO and IEC 20001. That's a long list there, David. I'm sure you've got some more you want to add to that, but do you mind just giving us a brief review of yourself and where you're at today?
Sure, thank you. Thank you for having me on as well, Khan. I really appreciate it.
No problem.
So that list is almost embarrassing, if I'm honest. It's a bit like my professional Tinder profile. Which means it's highlights. But for all of those things, they're really nice. I really appreciate them. But ultimately, it's how you do what you do that is most rewarding for myself and others. But yeah, it's good to have those endorsements.
Indeed.
For myself. It's really good. But they come from really a 30-year career in this particular sector in service management. So yeah, I'm a service management consultant. Mm-hmm. I work with organizations globally to help them build service management offices and models to enhance the service that they deliver to their colleagues and their customers. Mm-hmm. I focus a lot on how we co-create value, and also do a lot of work working with teams to help develop them into great service management teams and service related teams. So I work across organizations, work in many, many industries. I think at the last count, it's about 27 industries that I've worked in and around. So I don't see myself as an IT person. I see myself as a service or digital service management person that just happens to work in and around IT.
Sure. Okay. All right. Do you actually have a technical background, though, from an IT perspective, or not necessarily?
I started as a coder, and I suspect I was possibly the world's worst coder at the time. So that would be my LinkedIn profile now if I was still coding, world's worst coder. So yeah, that's where I started. But actually, the one thing I do have from a technical perspective, I seem to have an affinity with digital things. So my father's an engineer. Mm-hmm. You give him anything practical, he's incredible and I'm terrible. But for some reason, you give me a bit of technology or anything related to technology, I seem to have an affinity to do something with it and get value from it. And I don't know where that comes from. I guess it's my father's engineering background that somehow it's made its way into technology.
Out of interest, and you might not remember, but what was your first coding language back in 30 years ago when you kind of like started playing around with it?
Cicero C, if memory serves me correctly.
I missed that. Can you repeat that again?
Cicero C. Which I think was a form of COBOL.
Okay.
If I recall correctly. I remember the book. I remember the desk. I remember the man that I was working with. And I remember his size as he looked at my code. That's my biggest memories from that time.
Okay. To be fair, I've been in tech recruitment now for 25 years. So I've heard a lot of different technologies over the years. I haven't heard of Cicero C. I've heard of COBOL, though.
I think it was a COBOL version.
Yeah, so I'm aware of COBOL.
It could have been the book called Cicero. I honestly don't know. That's how much I know about coding.
Okay. So obviously, career initially, or playing around with coding, let's say with COBOL. So how did that transition into service management happen? Was it a career path that you chose, or did you kind of like fall into it?
like most people, I fell into it almost literally. So I, at that organization that I just spoke about, what we did is we designed back in the day IT systems for car dealers. So for Jaguar, for Ford, Honda. And I was terrible at it, as I mentioned. But as I also mentioned, I've got an affinity with tech. So they then kind of moved me into installation of those systems in garages. So I'd travel around the UK. I had my Astra van, which I loved. I'd shove my motorbike in the back of it as well. So wherever I went, I could take my bike out and a few computers. And I'd go and install garages in car dealerships, which I'm a bit of a petrol head, so it was great. Loved it. But then in my own personal life, I had a car crash. I was a passenger in a car crash, which wasn't too serious, but it just meant I couldn't drive for a period of time. And they popped me on the help on their help desk. And going on that help desk is what led me into service management. So the customers that I'd built that affinity with when I was in their buildings installing their computers would call the service desk or the help desk as it was and ask for me because they knew me, they knew the face. And then from there, I discovered that I love chatting with people and I could do things over the phone that other people on the help desk couldn't do. And some of that was down to the fact I'd been in the building, I'd seen the kit, I'd installed it, and therefore I knew what was wrong with it as well, because I knew the little shortcuts I'd taken to get it in certain places. Sure. And that's from there, basically, I ended up working for IBM Global Services.
Nice.
Which is another story, but the story very briefly goes that I was asked to train a couple of teams in a Windows 95 build, and there was two different builds for two different IBM customers. Mm-hmm. And IBM had signed a deal with those customers that they would support them both independently.
Sure.
But what they were really doing was spinning chair. So somebody would pick up the phone on one desk and then put that down and pick it up on another with a different build. Mm-hmm. And I taught those people how to use those builds. And then they said, well, why don't you just come and work for us? You could be part of this help desk. And that's really where service management kicked off for me.
Yeah, okay, I can imagine that. Going back to, sorry to hear about your crash, by the way, but when you kind of got put on that help desk for the first time, and essentially it was one of the very first roles I had to work as an IT recruiter, mm-hmm. the help desk role, and kind of getting an understanding of first line support and then going on to second and third line support. But I think it's a really important role. I think people going into those roles are underestimated in what's required, because I think it's not just about technology. I think a lot of it is about communication and service. Your transition from being like on-site engineer to going on to a help desk where you're on the phone talking to people, how did you find that transition? Like, and how did you find having those communication or those communication skills? How pivotal are they to that role in a help desk or a service desk role, essentially, or service management role?
So I think I found the transition fairly easy, to be honest, but I think it's because I did it in a different order to most people do it. So most people start on a service desk and go out as an engineer or a desktop person or a network engineer.
Sure.
But circumstances made me go the other way. Mm-hmm. So having that background of those sites and that kit meant that I felt comfortable visualizing what was going on. And you know, back in that day, you would genuinely get the phone call of my coffee holder was broken when they meant the CD-ROM. Genuinely. I must have had that call 100 times.
Yeah.
And the first time you get it, if you've not been somewhere, you're like, well, we don't deal with coffee holders. I don't, you know, and you refer them to facilities or something like that. But when you've been on site and you see people genuinely using the CD-ROM as their coffee holder, gives you a bit of a insight. And so I really benefited from that. But come back to your point about the importance. I think it's incredibly important that service desk people are given the two things, really, are when they're on the service desk, they're taken to the customer site that they're serving. They get to understand the layout, speak to a few people and build a relationship. And that should be a regular thing, not a one-time only thing. And I've done that when I've managed service desks. I've made sure my teams have gone out to the customer. But the second thing is, and you asked the question about how did I get into service management? The option for service management is rarely presented to service desk people as a career. Mm-hmm. the option for engineer or desktop person is, or even project person, is painfully obvious, but service management rarely comes into the mix. And I think that's something I'm really passionate about changing.
Do you know what,
and helping people develop.
Yeah, do you know what? Very, very interesting point, because I would agree with you 100%. I think the natural progression for someone working on a service desk would be to go into like a desktop support role, right? Move on to, mm-hmm. to the next line of support. So hearing you say that is, I suppose, music to my ears and ears of other individuals, because I think everyone kind of gets pigeonholed into that natural next step into desktop support, which is maybe a little bit more technical. But why aren't organisations maybe offering at that stage individuals an opportunity to go to service management? Is it too soon for service management? You know, should there be another layer maybe? Or is there an opportunity for someone from that service desk, you know, who has built up a little bit of experience to move into service management as a natural progression?
I personally see it as completely natural. So I'll answer the question in two parts. Mm-hmm. Is it natural? And then I'll do why don't organisations do it? Mm-hmm. So where I see it being natural is if you're on a service desk analyst and it's 10 a.m. and everything's settled down from the initial 9 a.m. rush on a Monday, and you see the calls queuing, you pick up the call and you hear your colleague dealing with the same thing as you, because you have to be listening to your call, but also observing what's going on around you.
Sure.
And somebody's talking about a network failure or something like that. As a service desk analyst, that set of observations that you're making around the call queue, I need to make sure I manage this call, get it to the right person, keep the customer happy, pick up the next call, alleviate the queue, or my colleague over there is taking a similar call. That's what service management is. That's reactive service management, at least. So if you then take that person and get them to look through that list of calls and understand why they came in at that time and how we could have improved the flow of those calls, maybe put them all together under a master and child and so on, you're talking knowledge management there.
Yeah.
That's a service management function. You're talking customer satisfaction and productivity, service management function. Talking service level management, another service management function. There's always somebody in the service desk that works well in that. And I think you could have a knowledge analyst in a service desk, a change analyst, a reporting analyst in the service desk. And that's their step towards service management. Why don't organizations do that? The reason they don't do that is they spend so much time firefighting that they think the next logical step is to another firefighting role. So desktop analyst, network analyst. If they kind of looked at their service desk and saw the skills that are in there, you've got people that when they pick up the phone, nobody is calling them to say, oh, are you having a nice day? They're calling them to say something's wrong. Mm. So their mental resilience, their ability to manage different things at the same time and work together to get an end result should be rewarded with so much more than just desktop or network. And I think those roles are great, by the way. But what I mean is the organization just sees them as a firefighting role. And therefore, that's why they don't explore the service management opportunities that are available to them. So I would always build the team to look at the analysis perspective, understand what's coming in, how could we react to it better? And then how could we be more proactive in stopping it from coming in the first place, which is knowledge management at its core.
And would you
even
say
proactive, sorry.
Sorry, I was going to say, like, would you say you've worked with organisations that do that well, that offer that career path from a service desk into a service management type role? Have you worked with some of those organisations before?
Just one. IBM.
Okay. So to me, then there's something drastically wrong in the marketplace. Then would you say?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
So how would you say we go about changing that as an industry to offer those service desk individuals a different career path? What needs to change?
So what needs to change is the perception that the service desk is only there to respond to incidents. Mm-hmm. That it's only there to react to what presents itself via the telephone or via chat or via the web page or self-service. And we're getting there from the perspective of using technology to inform and educate our consumers, our users, if that's what you want to call them, when they interact with the service desk, and knowledge bases and so on. But whenever I work in organisations, I still see them focusing mainly on the reactive elements and not the proactive elements. Mm-hmm. So within your service desk, at those periods where you can afford to give somebody a bit of flexibility to take on a bit more of a creative piece of work, ask them to go and do that. Have your team get together to understand what they could be doing better. And then I would lift that even more. In the organizations that I work with, I'm often on my own. I build communities of practice. Mm-hmm. Those communities exist to add value to the organization. Therefore, they're not just a technology community, they are a community for the organization. Nobody ever gets dragged there. The point is that we want to add value to the organization. But what that community ultimately does eventually is it flattens the hierarchy. So in one organization I've worked with, I've had the owners of the organization as part of the community and a service desk analyst, bring my hands in so you can see them, a service desk analyst from a supplier on there. And if you listen to the service desk analyst, they'll tell you what's wrong with your organization. And there's a gentleman who I'm going to name check, Daniel Breston. He's an ex-C-level person who said he did so many things wrong, but the one thing he really got right was he started to go down to the service desk to find out what was happening in his organization. And if you understand that's what your service desk does, it's a profile into everything that's wrong with your technology in your organization, and you listen to what they're dealing with, give them a voice, then you're going to enable your organization. And then you can start to put those people into service management roles. I know that's a long-winded answer, but the short answer is listen to your service desk.
It makes complete sense. And what Daniel Breston, is it Breston you mentioned?
Breston.
Breston. What he did makes absolute sense, because, I mean, I loved it. I love podcasts. I love listening to podcasts. And I listened to a podcast the other day where it was an entrepreneurial podcast, and they said the owners had previously hired McKinsey as a consultancy organization to look into what's wrong with their organization and how to fix it. And then they stopped using McKinsey and they said, why don't we just listen to all the complaints from our customers? Why don't we just listen and understand what they're saying to us, and we can develop internally and change internally what we're doing currently wrong and make it right. We don't need a consultancy organization to tell us that. We just need to listen to our customers, right? So I completely get what you said there about Daniel Breston. It makes complete sense to me.
Absolutely.
One thing I just wanted to go back on, and apologies, we're going back a little bit, but you mentioned that in that service desk role, how important it is for the individuals to understand the environment they're in. And I find, because I've worked with many managed service providers, that they've got hundreds of clients. The individual never ever gets to go and see that environment, right? They're literally on a service desk at the MSP site, answering calls, never really knowing or seeing the site that they're servicing. Is there a way around that because it's not just MSP, there's going to be other organisations in that boat. Is there a way around that at all from your point of view?
I believe so, especially nowadays with what we've got in front of us right now.
Yeah.
So bring on some people from the customer. Just ask them to come on for 10 minutes and tell you about their challenges.
Yeah, that's a good point.
About their day-to-day. Most of them will give up the time. We've all got customers that we know we can go and speak to and say, can I just get 10 minutes of your time?
Yeah.
Just if you could just come and tell the services what your challenges are day to day. So I worked in an organization where, and there are lots of organizations like this, they're multifaceted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they might have an arm that sort of deals in hospitality. Another part of the same organization deals in insurance. Maybe another part deals in facilitating customers via their own call center. Take those three people, bring them into a community or into a conversation, and just have them spend 5 minutes telling you, your team, what the challenges are they face. Don't try and find solutions on that call. Just say, yeah, well, we're going to think about that and we'll come back to you about how we can help.
Yeah.
And that then comes back to knowledge. If the part of the organization that's dealing in hospitality needs to interact with you in a different way because it's already facing its own customer, then put something together that enables them to interact with you in that way as well as you possibly can, but don't keep them on the telephone while they're trying to deal with their customer. However, if there's another part of the organization where they're not facing off to a customer, mm-hmm. and they're dealing with incoming inquiries via email or web forms, then maybe they can afford to call you.
Yeah.
So just know your customer, basically. And like you say, most MSPs, I've been part of MSPs, they'll sign a contract with an organization where people in that organization will be looking for value for money. They'll be looking for output. That output will be in the form of service level agreements and number of calls and so on. Unfortunately, we need to redefine that. It's got to be based on outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
And MSPs need to step up to the plate to look at outcomes and experiences. But frankly, customers also need to be guided down that path too. And we have to help them understand that we can give them a better service if we focus on outcomes and not just on outputs.
Yeah, do you know what? I think that makes complete sense. I think my only worry is that, knowing my relationship with some of the MSPs that we service, that they overlook that point. And if you ask me, it's a critical point for any service desk individual joining an MSP or a client, to have that interaction, even if it is 5-10 minutes interaction with an individual at the other end. I think sometimes the MSP, I'm trying to think of the right word, they overlook it, and I don't think they see the importance as much. Whereas actually, I think if they engage with a client and explain why it's needed, I think the client would understand and would actually give up the time to do that. I think, like you say, a lot of the times, once a contract's written between both sides, the MSP just feels like they just need to service every single call and not think about the way forward with new service desk individuals joining that. Does that make sense?
It does. And it really makes sense until the point where they come to renewal and they fall over themselves to try and add value.
Very, very true.
So if they think that far ahead to the renewal and say, how can we best position ourselves to be in the best position to actually take on this renewal? They did that from day one and not day 1001. They'd be in a much better position.
Yeah, okay, I agree with you. So you've set up your own consultancy, right? Soul 7 Studio, is that correct?
That's right, yes, yeah.
Okay, so you're providing your services out on a contract interim basis to a variety of different organisations. Well, the last count was 27 different industries, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, all right.
It's mad.
So can you give us a bit of a snapshot into some of the kind of you don't need to tell us the client names. I mean, obviously, we can look at that on LinkedIn, right? So some of the projects you've worked on, some of the complexities, some of the transformations you've been part of, because I'm guessing you've been on quite a few different journeys with some of these organisations, and it'd be really interesting for the listeners to understand some of those journeys from where it was when you kind of came in to where you finished, basically. Mm.
So I think the key to begin the answer is it's not down to me.
Mm-hmm.
It's genuine. It's not some sort of false humbleness. I'm really lucky that I get to work with organizations who I can see everything I've done wrong in the past and the organizations I've worked with have done wrong. And I get to build an audience with senior people in organizations to explain how we can do things right. And they accept that, which is fantastic. And they accept it because I talk about the power of community. I often work in organizations on my own or as part of a really small team. And I have been guilty, incredibly guilty in the past, of doing things to organisations. So I'll say, I'm an ITIL expert and your processes aren't good enough. And here's what you need to do to change them. And then I'll change them, I'll rewrite them for them, and I'll expect them to run with them. That doesn't work. You're doing something to people. So I learned a few years ago in a global banking organisation, pre-COVID, that the key to bring people together is to build community.
Mm.
And that community should be focused on a core set of objectives, which I call a charter, a value-focused charter. And that is something that, frankly, I and the team I worked with stumbled upon by mistake. So this is a real scenario. We'd meet with a global group every other week. We'd talk about what their challenges were. So all the stuff I've talked about a moment ago, we did, like, you know, what are your challenges, how can we help you? And then we'd figure out how we could use service management to deliver success. But we were still doing two. We were still going, we're the experts, we'll tell you what we need to do. And then something really cool happened. We did this thing where we spoke to all those stakeholders and we were assessing elements of the business, but we were saying to them, what does value mean to you? We were asking that literal question, what does value mean to you? And I still do this to this day, but now I do it by design, not by accident.
Sure.
And we catalogued all of the answers. And then one of the team came up with this brilliant idea, which was, let's take all of those answers, we'll put them into a document, and then we'll run them through some word cloud software. And we'll take the five most used answers and we'll make that our little logo. So those answers were strengthen, evidence, embed, value, and improve. Improve. Measure was there as well, but that was number six. So this little logo, we'd put it on our presentations and we were sending it out to people and saying, you know, here's our plan, here's our project plan, here's all the great stuff we're going to do. But our community was growing, which was great. But then a member of the community in Singapore got in touch with us and said, I've just seen your presentation on a screen in my office. Are you working with HR? And we were like, no, we're not. Then we heard from somebody in Mexico. And we heard from another person in London. And what had happened is this presentation had kind of been used and gone out, and other people were looking at the words and going, oh, that means something to us. We'll use that too. Mm-hmm. And so we contacted them and spoke to them. And at first they were like, oh, sorry for stealing your work. I'm like, no, it's great. Thank you. It's flattering. But they became part of our community. So now this service management piece of work we were doing was rebadged as service quality. And we were able to start to lift the quality in this global organization beyond service management into service design, into strategy, organizational and IT. We were able to look at objectives and align them to the strategy rather than them just being kind of empty objectives aligned to a leader who's aligned to another leader and another leader. Mm-hmm. But critically, we have the support of the leadership in the organization. And that's always critical. If you don't get that, you're onto a losing streak. So that's one engagement. And what we delivered there was improved existing services. But I think more pertinently, we delivered a closure in the gap between projects and portfolio and our service management teams. So we knew the pipeline of what was coming. We understood how it was going to impact digital services. We were able to prepare for it and build experiences into the design of these services. And so when those services landed, they didn't just land and then cause incidents. They landed and added value. And that was a group effort, not down to me.
Yeah.
But now, since then, I do that by design with organizations. Mm-hmm. And again, it's a group effort, but I go in with the, let's understand your maturity level today. And let's not downplay where it's bad, but let's not underplay where it's good. Let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. And often I find, in organizations, it's not down to capability, it's down to capacity. Yeah. And it returns me to my earlier statement, people fight fires. So when you build a community, you lift people out of that fire for just 2 hours every other week, and you get them to focus on how things could have been better and how they could contribute towards them being better in the future without them focusing on the event. Mm-hmm. And it becomes really helpful. So I've helped organizations change, and I've helped is key here, not I've done. I've helped organizations change their approach to consumers with new products and services. I've helped them mature their service management function and go way beyond that. And I've done that in various industries. And the model's always similar, and the outcomes are always similar, but the scenario is always different. And okay. you have to understand what you can control and what you can't control.
We interrupt this podcast to mention our sponsors, tech talent staffing firm Russell King Associates. If you're looking for work or looking for your next hire, please head to their website and register your interest at russellkingassociates.com. Right, back to the show.
One thing that you mentioned there which really stood out to me is about building the audience and a community. Mm-hmm. How do you go into an organisation and do that? How do you get people on site? How do you get them to want to be part of the journey that they're going to go on to make things better at the end of the day? Because let's be honest, some organisations have probably tried it in the past and maybe not succeeded. So how does this time around working, you know, with David at the forefront of it, how does that work?
So it works like any community by building a common consensus and not expecting to do it immediately. So you it always starts in service management, because I'm a service management consultant. So I'm not going to say I walk into an organization and they immediately give me HR and they immediately give me sales. It's never that way. But you go in, you speak to people about, you normally get a predetermined audience. So, you know, how does this work? Could it be improved? But what you do to make it work is you look at it from a different lens. Organizations look inside out. Service management functions are particularly critical of it. If you look from the outside in and you question everything you do from the customer's perspective, then it leads you down a bit of a different path, and ultimately it leads you to the customer. Then once you bring the customer into the conversation and get them to express how what you're doing isn't enabling them, and that customer can be a colleague in your organization or it could literally be a customer of your organization. Comes back to my point earlier around the service desk. You allow them to express, this doesn't work for me because. Then you involve them in the community. And then when you're speaking to people, you start to build momentum. So you basically find quick wins. And once you find quick wins and deliver results, then people want to join.
Yeah, I'm with you.
And then once you start to build that community, I then identify what I call impactors and influencers. Mm-hmm. Or you call them stakeholders, you can have a racy, however you choose. I can't stand racies, by the way, which is why I use impactors and influencers, although okay. I recognise the importance of racies. I'll say that now. I don't like racies because people build them and then nobody ever does anything with them. That's why I don't like them. But for me, an impactor is somebody that owns something. So they might own a team of people. They might own a budget. You need that person on site. We need them to be at least aware and bought in. Mm-hmm. But influencers are the people that work in or around the organizations that have a voice. Mm. Those that have a positive voice, harness that voice, have them go out into the organization and say, I'm part of this great community, it's doing good things. Come and join us. It's completely of your own free will, never dragged, never forced. Also, influencers might go, this community is the biggest bunch of whatever. I immediately go for those people and I go and understand why they think it's that way. And I don't try and dissuade them. Just understand why they feel that way. And I reckon 9 times out of 10, they end up joining the community, because I'll basically say to them, but if you want to make a difference, come and join us.
Yeah, it's good. Really good.
And intrigue gets the better of them and they come along. And so the reason it works is because it's sustainable. So in the organizations that I've worked with, I believe most of them still have the community and they have roles that fulfill that community function that we've designed together. But ultimately, it boils down, you've heard me use knowledge now several times, it boils down to knowledge management. So knowledge for me is the most critical aspect of any organization. It's evolution and it's improvement. We all have great knowledge, don't we? You know, what you're doing today is you are taking the knowledge from my head and imparting it to your audience. And they can choose to do whatever they want with it. They could go, David's an idiot, and disregard it. Or they could go, oh, he's saying some good stuff. I'd like to learn more. And so in those organizations, we build knowledge that's accessible. So we give them platforms like this. Mm-hmm. Because there's so much in people's heads, you need to release it. So we'll have conversations like this. I will literally do what we talked about a moment ago. I'll get a customer on a sort of 9-minute video and I'll say, how don't we help you? How could we help you? And let's talk about what's next. It brings it to life.
Yeah.
then I'll have somebody from the recipient team talk about how they've done that and how they've improved it. But I'll also document it in different places. So it's all down to knowledge. So to answer your question, eventually, the reason these things work is we set out to document and make knowledge accessible, relevant, and available. We agree on a language. That language is something anyone in the organization can understand. But ultimately, we look at things from the outside in. We don't just say, what are we doing wrong? We say, how is what we're doing wrong impacting our customers, our colleagues, and how can we improve that from the outside in? And once you change that lens, it's really interesting. Coming back to my coding days, which were very few, but I had no concept of how what I was doing on that keyboard was going to impact that customer. And if you look at the way we work today with DevOps and service management, often seen as these two opposing ways of working, they're not at all. They're both interested in the same thing, enabling customers. The problem is that DevOps is further to the left and therefore more distance from the customer. So if you bridge that gap, help them understand how what they're doing today is going to improve things tomorrow, and help service management understand how they can best facilitate that, and project management do the same.
Yeah.
You're laughing, but you need to bring those people together, and that's what a community does.
Well, 100%, I agree with you there. It's all about building the right community that's going to be working to an ultimate goal at the end of the day. And it sounds like, obviously, that something you're successful in doing in most of your roles. I think another thing you mentioned, which kind of stood out to me, is having, I'm trying to think, the support of the leadership, you said.
Yeah.
Now, you tell me, is this something that, like, is your role being brought on by leadership that actually want to make the right change, or are they make, or sometimes are you brought on because they think it's what they need to do, or are they unsure sometimes? And at what stage do you say, actually, I am the right person, or actually, you don't need me at this stage? Do you ever do that? You know, if you can give the listeners a bit of an insight into that.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I turn down more than I get offered, but I do turn down where I don't think it's the right time.
Yeah.
So I work in kind of, I work in ISO, sort of building service management standards as part of the ISO committee. Mm-hmm. Where I never think it's the right time, unless we have a conversation that I can develop, is we need to get more mature, or we need to be more mature, or we need to improve our IT, blah, blah, blah. The reason I have to think about those carefully is IT has been used as a governance method for far too long. And the belief is that if you're mature in IT, therefore you're well run. Unfortunately, that's not the case. So I will speak with organizations about, why do you want to do this? What is it you're looking to deliver? And you can often get an idea that there is a desire to improve, but maybe not a capacity to do so. So I try to understand the capacity of the organization in terms of what are people doing. And then I can help with the capability. That's cool. What I can't help with is the capacity if they're not willing to help themselves.
Yeah.
So I can find ways to release capacity through knowledge management and so on. But I need to know that people are going to be working with me. If they think I can just go in and wave a magic wand and I feel like that's the case, then it's not the work for me. I don't attempt to take on things that I can't possibly deliver. Some leadership teams just have a list of objectives and I tick a box for one of those objectives. Others have a list of objectives and they understand why they need them and how I can help.
You summed up really brilliantly there, because I feel like some of the organisations that we represent, they are sitting in one of those camps. I feel like sometimes it's just a tick box exercise to say that they're doing it rather than actually needing and wanting to do it for the community and for process improvement. So you mentioned there were times that you've chosen to maybe turn it down because it's not the right time. Can you maybe give us an example of something maybe you've turned down where it's not been the right time? And have you been invited back at a later stage to get involved?
Yes and yes. Yeah. So I can't name the company, but it's a managed service provider,
yeah,
who does a lot more than that. And they wanted me to go and basically sort out a client arrangement with them. But I knew the client, if I'm honest, and I spoke to the client and I could see it was too long gone. So what I said to them was, this isn't the right time. I don't think I can deliver the result that you need. Because I work to statements of work. I don't work to contracts.
Sure. Okay.
So I'm not a contractor. So
SOWs only.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm SOWs only. So that means I've got to have faith that what I say I can deliver, I'll deliver. I'm insured to the hilt for that kind of stuff. But I said, what I can do is I can help you with your onboarding of your next client. And I can, coming back to our scenario earlier, I can help you think ahead to when that client's going to want to leave, and I can help you prevent that from happening. I can help you satisfactorily onboard their services, their teams. I can build you a community that will focus on that in the future. What I can't do is undo 4 years of bad service.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you know, in the best will in the world, can't do it. You've made that bed. I'm afraid you're going to have to lie in it. And it's not an easy conversation to have, because A, don't like turning down work, because everyone needs to make a living and pay the bills. But it comes down to, do I really think I can help? And if the answer is no, then why do it? And that is born out of my career before going independent, where I would work for organisations. I'd go and work on troubled accounts. And I'd try and undo what had gone wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd try and redo what had gone right. But ultimately, from a commercial perspective, my hands would be tied. I couldn't give the right advice. I could only give my organization's right advice.
Sure.
Today, I have the opportunity to give the right advice. But that's the right advice in my eyes, obviously. So that means it's got a star next to it, David Barrow's correct advice. But hopefully it's well judged. So I have to kind of live by that. If I don't think my advice is going to help, due to circumstances out of my control, then I choose not to take the work on.
I like what you just said about living by that, because on your LinkedIn profile, you've put down your mission is to humanise IT and co-create value with your clients, partners and peers. I really like that. I feel like that really sums you up.
thank you.
And I think it's important for all of us to have a mission, have those values, and they need to lead to something that's going to ultimately transform what we are delivering to our clients. And I do that with my client base. You know, I have a certain set of values and missions that I work to build my community, to deliver to my community, and to deliver to my clients. And for me, it's really important in regards to us as individuals in any industry or any sector. Without those missions or values, I think people see through them. And what are you trying to deliver at the end of the day? So, I mean, would you say that your values and mission are set in stone, or do they change on a regular basis for you?
The co-creation of value thing will never change.
Mm-hmm.
That's just absolute. I think what could not change but evolve is I'd still like to be more involved with organisations' customers, and they don't always allow me to do so. And I'm probably going to end up morphing that into developing their teams. And what I mean by that is that value co-creation element is I always try and make sure that when I go on to the next engagement, that there's not a hole left behind where I once was. And it's not always easy to do, but I think I want to add it to kind of my core work statements now, which is I will find for you within your organization somebody that can do what I do.
Mm-hmm.
And I try and do that, but it's not part of my key service offering right now. But I think that's a value that I'd like to sort of add. I guess it moves down to co-create value.
Yeah,
I think where it will change is possibly the day I need to, I don't know, mortgage rates are going up, aren't they? Maybe I'll need to change to suit the scenario at the time.
My mortgage changed this month. It's hurting me, so I get that feeling. just so our listeners understand, because you mentioned statement of work, so I know it's SOW, statement of works. Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate a little bit on that for those that really don't understand what a statement of works is?
Mm, sure. So there's, I could really dive into a bit of detail that people may or may not want to hear, but I'll just do it very quickly. Yeah. As a self-employed person, which is what I am, as a consultant, HMRC can judge me, or judge my engagement at least, as either disguised employment inside IR35 mm-hmm. or truly self-employed outside IR35. And the key for me to deliver that is through statements of work, which is an agreement between the client and I as to what I will achieve and do in the period of time that we work together. Within there, it includes, you know, it's all about my expertise, but it would normally involve me having to have a series of conversations with the client, which for anybody watching means you're going to be doing loss leading work mm-hmm. and be doing stuff for free. But in those conversations, you're discovering what they need, helping them understand what you think they need, and then designing a statement of work to fulfill those needs over a period of time. So it's very different to a contract. So a contractor should be engaged to do a specific job which the client defines. Statement of work is something you mutually define to deliver a set of outcomes.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And look, 100% of our business is placing interim contractors. The majority falling inside of IR35. And for you listeners out there, I'll do another session on IR35. It's a minefield in itself. Yeah, so I completely get the statement of works. It's you and the end client understanding what needs to be delivered mutually and then going upon delivering those, right? So it sits outside of IR35, which means it's a statement of works piece of work. Interestingly for me is, how do you go about winning your work? Like, you've set up Soul 7 Studio. How are clients coming to you, or are you having to still use agencies like myself, you know, that set up, or, you know, are you advertising, or is it just word of mouth? You know, tell me about that a little bit.
Hmm. I'd say it's a combo of all, but I have to name check the ITSM people. So that's a company I work with, who I've had a lot of my engagements through over the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. So the ITSM people is run by a chap called Tim Mills, and he's really helpful because he basically helps me build the engagement, and in return, I guess I help him win the engagement. So we work together an awful lot using one another's knowledge. And then the rest of it is, I've been really fortunate over the last few years, is through word of mouth. I've actually only on Friday changed my LinkedIn to open to work, because I'm just finishing up a piece of work with a client now, mm-hmm. anticipating I'll be around and free in April, which isn't, I'm not marketing here, but
feel free to market. This is what it says.
Oh, why not? I'm free April 1st. Anyone needs me,
anyone that's listening, he's free from April.
But I've been really fortunate that work's come to me over these last few years. Mm-hmm. But I think that's all about timing, and you know, you have to be, I believe, in this situation, a self-starter. Which is why I've gone and selected open to work 4 weeks before, you know, we're due to finish. It's to start getting a different way of inquiries coming in. So I use my website for inquiries. My LinkedIn is my main marketing tool, to be perfectly honest. I mean, I don't know where I'd be without LinkedIn as a business. It's a great way to get a voice out there. But then you mentioned, we discussed SIPs prior to the call. Going to events like that, showing your face, having conversations with people. And again, I've been fortunate in the last few years that I'm doing public speaking to support the books and to support myself. All those avenues lead to work. But like anybody, ultimately, I'm on the jobs boards, looking around, making sure that I can see what's going on in the marketplace and hit and apply where I need to.
Okay, good. And for those listeners out, if you don't know what SITS is, it is the Service Desk and IT Support Show. It's an event being held at the XL on the 17th and 18th of April. And actually, David, you're going to be there doing two talks, if I'm not wrong. One is on the post office scandal, which, by the way, I love the documentary which ITV did about that. So mm-hmm. I will definitely be listening to that out of interest, because I think you've got a great panel on board as well. So if you could tell me a little bit about that and the other talk, because I actually don't know what the other talk's about, so it'd be interesting to understand that.
Sure. So we'll start with the post office one, not because it's, well, it is more important from the perspective of national news, but the subject of the other one's incredibly important too. So the post office one, that's one that I've really had to think carefully about, if I'm perfectly honest. Sits were kind enough to come and ask me if I'd chair the panel for this one. Mm-hmm. And the truth is that's a subject that has to be dealt with real empathy. Many people were impacted negatively by the Horizon and still are by the Horizon IT scandal. Not least of all the people that worked in that organization supporting that product. Mm-hmm. And people that were they were let down by the leadership. And that has resulted, if we're looking at that outside in view that I mentioned earlier, that's resulted in real people in post offices being let down. And, to a far greater effect than I could ever wish to cover. So as a panel, we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about maybe where service management could have helped, mm-hmm. especially modern day service management. We're talking about humanizing IT, building experiences, understanding outcomes. We're going to talk about those things, but we're also going to talk about mental health and well-being and the PTSD that could have come from those events. So the panel that we've got is great. We've got Simone, who's just so energetic and is so much about humanizing IT and mental health and well-being that she's going to be incredible on the panel. We've got Sophie Hussey, who's a service management consultant, expert, again, is full of empathy for the people that we're dealing with. We've got Patrick, who's a senior operations manager and director, who, again, we all share the same empathy, but what Patrick can offer is that day-to-day operations executive view. And we've got Becky, who works for a well-known UK sports brand as an operations manager, and she's going to bring us that real-world view from the service desk and the operations perspective. And I'll be just chairing and okay. running the panel. So I think that's going to be really interesting. We're going to have to treat it appropriately.
Yeah.
I don't think any of us is taking that lightly. So, and we will be encouraging questions from the audience on the day. So that's going to be a really stimulating conversation, I think.
I think you might have a couple from me as well, I tell you.
it's one that we're not taking lightly and we feel the correct amount of pressure for. The other topic is important. I can't say it's important as the post office piece, but it is in a different way. It's about allyship. It's about helping one another. Mm-hmm. Predominantly, this conversation is going to be with a lady called Lucy Grimwade. Lucy and I are partnering on this. Lucy and I work together in the Women in Technology program with Reed. We're both mentors on that program. And we're going to talk about the importance of offering allyship to one another, regardless of sexual orientation, belief, religion, etc. Mm-hmm. But we're also going to be offering, as we were with the post office piece, a toolkit, how to be a better ally, how to help one another, how to spot people that need help and what to do next. And we're hopeful that'll be a really interesting and intriguing session. And you can see neither of those is really about service management, but both of them are about using the skills we've learned in service management, which is empathy, listening, observing, asking. And that's why I believe service management transcends just IT. Coming back to my first point, is it teaches you those skills. And if you have those skills, you can be a successful service manager and professional too.
Good. I think they're both great, great topics. Really looking forward to both. Are you there on both days at SITS?
Yep. The allyship session, I believe, is at 3 p.m. on day one. Mm-hmm. And the post office session is at 11 a.m. on day two.
Oh, okay. That means I have to go to both days now. I look forward to seeing you there.
Thank you.
Moving on, let's talk about, because you've written a couple of books, right? Mm. It'd be really interesting for the listeners to understand, because I think what would be really good for me to know, and the listeners, is that all of us have our expertise. We're all good at something at the end of the day. We're all passionate about something. Not everyone writes a book. First, what made you write a book and then another book? And tell us a bit about the books and what's involved and the time and effort that goes into it as well. That'd be really interesting to know.
So co-creating value in organizations are vital for, I was invited to write it out of the blue.
Okay.
And it came from the fact that I did a few blogs and I guess in short form wrote passionately about service management and the use of ITIL both correctly and incorrectly in my mind. So co-creating value in organizations of ITIL 4 is written about understanding what it's there to do, looking at the guiding principles of ITIL 4, like focus on value, start where you are, and giving the reader real scenarios from my experience where I've used those guiding principles to apply ITIL and to improve organizations. So much of what we've talked about today, community, knowledge, language, but in long form with real personal stories, real examples and graphics to illustrate that. And education and service management came out of the fact, the question that you asked earlier, that pretty much everybody I know has fallen into service management. And I want organizations and people to understand that this is a career and it's one that you can form and nurture. So an education in service management, again, has real-world stories, but this time not affiliated with ITIL, just service management in general. I've been able to go into more depth in some cases about my time saving a diver's life from sharks, saving an elephant's life during a major incident, and I'm not going to give anything away more than that. But the real world of service management, warts and all. And within there is... a guide and recommendations of organizations to join, to learn more, courses to take, what benefits they offer and so on. But that's really built around my passion to enable people to make a successful service management career. And also to tell organizational leaders, you need to give these people the enablement to deliver a successful career. In terms of the effort, I can't lie, it's not easy. Came out of school at the age of 16, couldn't wait to get out, came out with very few GCSEs and English wasn't one of them. So Grammarly is my friend, the installation of Grammarly. But writing a book is cathartic, I think. Not easy, but cathartic. It enables you to release some of those thoughts and then you have a great, thankfully you've got copy editors that kind of bring them back into line again. So it's a long process. You're probably talking from the moment you start where you have to write a product description, what you're going to talk about, who might read it, what the paragraphs are going to look like. That's the first job you have to do. That's a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
You're probably talking a year from the moment you start to the moment it gets submitted for publication. So if you're writing something, think about the future, not just the present day.
Yeah.
But also, if you make notes, if you've got notes, if you've got materials, never throw them away. So the first and second book, I'm working on a third now, all come from my core materials, all the notes I've kept over the years. It was just me putting them into some sort of order and telling stories. So yeah, it's definitely cathartic. It's definitely hard work. But I think it's worth it.
It's really interesting to hear. Like you, I left school with very few GCSEs. English wasn't one of them. So I also use Grammarly every day.
That is great.
Yeah, exactly. So I get it. Third book you mentioned there. So are you able to give us a little insight or snapshot into what that's about?
Yeah, so this is going to be entirely different. Working title is All You've Ever Wanted to Know About Allyship But Never Dared to Ask. It's with Lucy, who's the lady I'm presenting with at SITS. And we're writing together, and it's going to be a novel, which will be interesting, with a number of contributors, where we are going to write about our lives from different perspectives, male and female. So these are going to be real stories, but set up around characters. So here's a little snippet. When you or I go to a Christmas party, what do we think about? Tux, no tux, tie, no tie.
Mm-hmm.
Now put yourself in a woman's shoes, in a professional environment. What does she think about? How do people react to her? How is she judged? How long does that last for? A lot longer than whether we choose to wear a tie or a bow tie. So the book is going to talk about our lives, along with our guests' lives, who are going to be characters within the book. And we're going to talk about silly little things like job descriptions that say him, how that makes us feel. And we're going to talk about male bias. We're going to talk about so many things. But ultimately, it's going to be a novel that we hope is also going to be fun and going to be educational. And hey, that's it. I know that's it's literally in the throes of being put together now. So we'll see what comes out at the end.
It sounds really, really interesting. A great concept of what you're talking about there. And I think we're all probably guilty of this, but we don't really think about what the other person or the other individual is thinking in circumstances like you mentioned there. And one thing you actually mentioned, which I just want to pick up on and see if what your thoughts are on it, because you mentioned something about the job description and using the word he, I think, in the title. And do you see that still to this day? And
yeah,
a lot.
Not a lot, but still see it.
Yeah.
Or see the insinuation as well.
Because I would say that I still see it as a recruiter. I see it a lot, and I have to reword a lot of the job descriptions that we get from our client base. So it's really interesting to hear that, because I didn't know if it was just from me being a recruiter's point of view, but it's interesting hearing it from your point of view as well, that is still out there. Obviously, we're getting towards the end of the podcast. Obviously, I could talk all day. I could keep going, but if I could, seriously. We're getting up to an hour, and I could probably go on for another hour, but we've both got things to do. So if someone wanted to buy your book, where could they go and get that at the moment, David?
So in Education and Service Management, which is just there, that can be bought from IT Governance Publishing. It's also available on Amazon, Apple Books, so on. And Co-Creating Value in Organisations, which I don't think was in the shop, which is there, nice. TSO. Again, also Amazon, Apple Books. You can buy both of these books in PDF format, in online devices, your phone and so on. And an Education Service Management, we're just recording the audio book now, so that'll be out as an audio book in the next couple of months.
Good.
If anyone wants to wait till then.
Good. I've got a few more questions. I don't want to say questions, but obviously, we spoke a lot about business life and career life. Tell me about David outside of the workplace.
Outside of the workplace, I'm currently training for an ultramarathon, so that's keeping me busy.
Nice. And remind me, how long is the ultramarathon? How long is an ultramarathon?
This one's 50K, so 30-odd miles. But ultimately, what I like to do is separate myself from all of this kit and do ceramics. I don't think there's anything of mine nearby. But yeah, I do pottery. So I sit in front of a wheel and get really dirty. And it's great because it means I can literally get away from the digital world.
How often does that happen, the pottery?
When I wasn't preparing for the ultramarathon, like weekends and after work, but now it's that time's taken. I'm at long distances now, so it's taken up by running at the minute. But yeah, weekly. And that's kind of the concept behind Soul 7 Studio, is the Sol is the sun, so that our home is solar powered. So is the pottery kiln and the wheel and so on. So is all the kit I'm speaking to you on now, especially today, which is good. But the point of it being a studio is I see myself as much more than just an IT consultant. So I'm a ceramicist, I'm a writer, blogger, speaker, and I'm in partnership with my wife, who's an artist. And so that's the idea behind it being a studio, is that anyone's welcome. We can all contribute and deliver together. And ultimately, it comes back to those beliefs of co-creating value.
Yeah.
And that's the great thing around pottery, is I make something and then somebody gets to use it every day as a cup, as a plate. That's value co-creation for me.
Yeah, great. I love it. I love the whole studio piece. And what part of the UK are you from?
Just south of London, Reigate.
Reigate. I know Reigate. Yeah.
Nice. And yourself?
I live in Kent now, in Bexley, but I used to live in Purley, Surrey, so not many miles from Reigate, so I know the area well. Yeah. And then just to finish off, really, last question, where do you see the future of IT service management? You know, how much different will it be compared to where we are today with it?
So this is a short shrift answer. We take the IT out of it for a while. It's not just IT anymore. IT, the days of IT being a department, that's a central function, are long gone. just everyone else needs to catch up. Every organization uses digital today. So I believe we're in the midst of the fourth industrial revolution, the information age, which is what ITIL4 is based on.
Yeah.
And everyone needs to catch up. So the future for me is service management is an enterprise function that enables the organization as a whole, that is a genuine career choice just as much as an accountant or a doctor is. Because ultimately, everything we do, including accountants and doctors, are stimulated by digital services. Mm-hmm. And as AI comes along and people talk about taking the jobs, I think it creates our jobs. It creates jobs in understanding, assessing, formulating, designing, and ultimately running digital services that the world can benefit from. And sustainability in digital is huge right now. And I think there's so many careers around that are service management related.
It's good, really good. I look forward to hearing more when I see you at SITS. I really appreciate you jumping online this morning with us and letting our listeners hear your background, your story, and find out a bit more about your books and Soul 7 Studios. Any last comments before we finish off for the session?
Just to say, if you'd like to hear more, I'm always on LinkedIn, so you can find me on there, I'm sure. And to say thank you very much. Really appreciate you having me on. It's been a fantastic conversation. And hope it's useful for people.
Definitely. Great. Right. Well, thank you for being on Tech Life Stories. And we will hopefully in the future have you on again.
Hope so. Thank you.
No problem at all. I'll speak to you soon.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the podcast, Tech Life Stories, sponsored by tech talent staffing firm Russell King Associates. If you like what you hear, please leave a review on the podcast platform you are listening from. If you'd like to hear more from me, you can find me posting daily on LinkedIn, so look me up and connect. Remember, it's not what people think of you when you first start, it's what people think of you when you finish.